Shalom and welcome again to Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm Rabbi Richard Adress, your host and the director of Jewish Sacred Aging. And we welcome you to another one of our hopefully exciting and informative sessions. As you know, these podcasts are designed to explore some of the issues related to our own longevity and the implications of the longevity revolution within our own families and our own community. And if you'd like to email me with suggestions or comments on these podcasts, please feel free to do so at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we are very honored to have with us really one of the truly great pioneers in the American Jewish community, Rabbi Simcha Weintraub. Really, without exaggeration, the pioneer, one of the great creators of the whole Jewish healing movement, recently relocated, made the wise move from New York, and has transferred back down here to Philadelphia. Civilization, much better sports teams, although not this year. Anyway, Simcha, welcome. Welcome. It's a pleasure to see you again. We have done some work together in the past. You were responsible for over a quarter of a century for working in the Jewish Healing Movement, the National Center for Jewish Healing out of the New York Board and New York Healing Center. I have to ask you, because you really had this vision, what drew you to create this?
I guess personally, I have to say that I knew that I wanted during rabbinical school to also do a social work degree. And I was actually interested in family therapy. And when I stirred those two things together, I was trying to figure out how to integrate them in a way that could help people. And at the time, the four mothers of the Jewish healing movement, rabbis Amy Eilberg, Rachel Cowan, Nancy Flamm, Susan Friedman, were talking about the way that Jews who were suffering were not accessing Jewish spiritual resources. That there were some chaplains, and chaplaincy was actually suffering greatly at that time in terms of funding. But the community itself, the Jewish community itself, did not know what to do with cancer, and certainly did not know what to do with AIDS, HIV/AIDS. And so in the early 90s, we began talking about the need for a Jewish healing center. We didn't have it geographically located initially, but it started to grow both in San Francisco and New York, and ultimately in 36 cities. Jewish healing program began. And the purpose of it was really, I would say, threefold. One was to help enable clergy and Bikur Cholim volunteers and synagogues in general to more fully address the spiritual needs of people who were dealing with loss, serious illness, or trauma. We also wanted to help Jewish and non-Jewish mental health professionals to integrate spiritual searching and spiritual resources into their work of helping people. In other words, to take a whole person approach. At the Jewish Board, they used to call it the biopsychosocial spiritual approach to the human being. So that's really the origins of the work and what really drew me to it.
The healing movement, which you and your colleagues, really pioneered, as you mentioned, in the 90s, and there were healing centers in a huge number of cities, not only in the United States, but I think around in many places around the world. Am I correct in from just observation and working a little bit with the Jewish Sacred Aging work, that a lot of these centers have now either been folded into something else or disappeared? And if so, was it the wave crested? Was it the funding issue? Was it the community moved to something else? I know, is this a correct assumption? And if so, why?
Yes, you're right. And it really is both of those reasons. In terms of the 2/3 of the Jewish healing programs were based in Jewish family service agencies, which were really opening up to the idea of this whole person approach and integrating Jewish content and Jewish spirituality into the work. But the funding ran out, and the kind of foci of the agencies also had to shift because of government and the reality around us. So the other thing to say is that Debbie Friedman's Misha Berach, just to give that one example, was so much of a successful wave to influence really so much of American and other Jewries around the world in terms of addressing illness and bereavement, and the work of Ann Brenner and so many leaders. So I think that what also happened is that, and we were very happy about this, that there were seeds of change planted that began to take root and in different ways in different places. So I'm sad that there aren't these Jewish healing programs or projects in all those places still, but I'm happy that in synagogues and in other place schools, there's more going on to address people who are suffering.
Well, I think the credit that you and that pioneer group deserve, rightfully so, is the fact that you planted all these seeds, and these seeds have grown and matured in congregations and organizations. There's not a congregation that I'm aware of that doesn't have, you know, revitalized Misha Berach prayer on Erev Shabbat or Shabbat morning with the Torah scroll out, and the power of music, where Perry Smilo is supposed to be, I think, is up next week on a Seekers of Meaning podcast to really elaborate more about the power of music in the healing process, and the whole explosion of ritual in our rabbinate, you know, in the time of our, since we were ordained, the new rituals workshop that we do is one of the most popularly requested. The power of ritual and healing. Talk to me about what you've seen, what you've witnessed, and the way people now are using rituals, creative rituals, or reimagining traditional rituals in the process of healing, both corporate healing and personal healing.
So what I see is that people are being given an opportunity both to draw on very ancient and deep wisdom and insights, while being empowered to add their voice and have it respected and heard. So there's nothing better than a clergy member or a lay leader who knows their community and knows kind of their vocabulary and their idiom to evolve a ritual. I wrote a prayer for COVID for somebody whose dear one has the COVID virus, but it really needs to be adjusted. Anything needs to be adjusted kind of locally and with the realities of the community. So I think there is this generating of music and of new music for old verses of psalms and then the creation of new prayers and it's all I think that's how it was through Jewish history. And I think I was thinking about the 17th century Ma'avar Yavok, the work by a Kabbalistic rabbi in northern Italy who developed many prayers and rituals for serious illness and bereavement. And I was thinking of one in particular where he took verses from the Torah that had the verb lech, go. And when somebody was very near death, he says, to gather 8 friends of the individual who's nearing death and have them say these lines. And he composed a prayer with lines from Psalms and elsewhere, Isaiah, which it begins, Lech kishilach echa Adonai, go for God has sent for you. And it was an incredible thing to look at now in the 21st century.
No, it's fascinating. And you and that pioneering group really, I think, gave permission in a way for lay people to really say, well, I'm not a rabbi, I'm not a Jewish scholar, but this is coming from my soul and I want to write something. I need to either rituals of transition, grief rituals, rituals of celebration, the revitalization of the mikveh, or the Gomel blessings. These have just come there in the New Reform Prayer Book. I mean, so it's fascinating. And to know that you and that cohort, you know, in the 90s really planted these seeds, I think it's just a powerful, powerful legacy. So you also are very involved in the Bikur Cholim project, the Bikur Cholim movement. So let me take 2 seconds to remind people that there's a Bikur Cholim National Conference on now, just started last Monday night. And you're speaking at this conference in later on, I think in March, you mentioned.
Yes.
The Bikur Cholim, which is co-sponsored by a whole variety of chaplains organizations, Kavod V'Nichum, a couple other places. And a brief word in case people are interested, because people who may be listening to this involved in their Caring Community program or Bikur Cholim or the Chevra Kadisha, this is a program that's on Monday nights. It's Zoom. It's every other Monday night. It started last Monday on January 10th. And it's a program to address some of the ongoing emerging challenges from the pandemic, including dealing with long-term problems, compassion fatigue, disenfranchised guilt, grief, which is something I do want to talk to you about as well. The conference registration is $72. There is scholarship money available. And if you want to register for information, register for the conference, go to the Kavod V'Nichum website, which is www.jewish-funerals.org. That's jewish-funerals.org. And you'll be able to catch up to the program, the sponsorship, the schedule, and you'll be able to check out when Rabbi Weintraub is speaking. Grief and the Bikur Cholim. You've done the Omen work in this. You've taught this. You led seminars. JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary, physicians, organizations. I asked this of somebody else whose podcast is coming up in a couple of weeks. Simcha, do we do grief well in the United States of America, in Western civilization?
Nope.
Hey, good.
I mean, I think we're on a journey now. I think that there was a time when our society was really death-denying and grief-aversive, and the Jewish community included in that. And I think that's another thing that's shifting with Reimagine and with other projects and things I don't even know about. There's a real opening up to the need to talk about death and to take people's experiences seriously, their experiences of dying and losing someone. And so I think there's a real shift there, and plus a real understanding of the death is not just a medical process and not just a individual personal one, but it's an interpersonal one, and it's certainly a spiritual one, and there can be accompaniment, and there needs to be accompaniment, not just of the corpse, but of the person as they're actively dying, and certainly of the family members and friends. So I think there's a real opening now in the Jewish community and general community as well.
we're still living through this pandemic. And you did some work in teaching and organizing around these issues post 9/11, which was a national trauma. I'm now convinced that what we're living through with this pandemic now for 2 years is also a not only national but global trauma, which we're going to be living with for years. Am I wrong to associate the word trauma to what we've lived through? What we've lived through in these last 2 years?
It's absolutely the word. The nature of something coming from left field, and hitting people of all races, classes, religions, of course we know that some are being hit more than others, but it's definitely trauma is almost too small a word for it. It's because it's continuing and compounding itself. There was just a piece in the Times about prolonged grief. There's a new name that the DSM-5 or whatever has given to complicated grief, or to now they're calling it prolonged grief, and that's interesting. But the whole article didn't have the word spiritual once, not once in the whole article. Yeah. And so I wonder how successful a social worker or a psychiatrist, a psychologist, can be without being aware of the overwhelming nature of this pandemic in terms of the sense of the universe and the sense of time and life and meaning and belief. I mean, it's really pulling the rug out from all of that, and I think that's a trauma. That's a compounded trauma.
Well, you know, the fact that you're an LCSW social worker in addition to ordination, and this is a sort of like worked its way through your entire rabbinate. I just want to ask your opinion on something, because we're picking this up in our work in Jewish Sacred Aging, the impact of this now 2 year trauma on clergy. Have you done any work with clergy? Because I'm picking up a tremendous amount of just, I've had it, you know, I'm burned out. I'm and stress, and especially people dealing with younger children and families and their job and their career and the congregation or their organ. And it's like, I can't. Have you picked up, are you working with any of this?
Oh yeah, a great deal. The typical exchange for me now is, or a rabbi will contact me by email or by phone, and say they want to talk about responding to the COVID reality or to the newest variant, and my first question is, what are you going through? And they'll tell me what the congregation is going through, and I'll say, no. What are you going through? And what are you dreaming about at night? What are you sleeping at night? You know what? And so I think we haven't. We're behind we're behind in terms of not being helping people be prepared for. Not that you can fully prepare, but at least have the right tools to generate, a sensitive and adequate response. But I it's interesting. I'll just tell you. I think this is okay to say. I went to my first meeting of the Greater Philadelphia Rabbinical Assembly region, and I went with the purpose of joining and being with colleagues, but also I wanted to push the work with Afghan refugees that I was hoping that many congregations would take up, and they were very willing to talk about that. But then I got an email saying, "Would you lead a workshop on COVID and the trauma?" I hadn't mentioned it, but that's what people need, and I think not that we can put aside the Afghan refugees, but I think we need really to help one another sort out what's happening.
Yeah, I think this impact is really going to have a significant impact on clergy across the denominational lines, especially congregational clergy, who in many cases are just dealing with so much by themselves that they may not have a huge staff. One of the other things I wanted to just talk to you about, because you've been intimately involved with this, as we were talking before we started the podcast, it was an article last month in December in the New York Times. I think it was a Sunday New York Times. Very, very disturbing article about the dark web and youth suicide. It's a long, long, three or four or five page article just detailing how these kids get sucked in. And you're involved with a group called Nakom Shalom, which you still either run or are involved with, that deals with suicide and youth suicide. Talk to me about what you're seeing. Talk to me, first of all, let people know about this group and also this other program you're involved with parents, correct?
Yes.
So what are these groups? How will somebody contact you if they're interested, if they're being touched by this? And then talk to me about this, what you're finding in with this whole explosion of youth suicide.
So unfortunately, in the Jewish community, as in the general community, it is absolutely true that there's an epidemic of suicide among young people, but also apparently among the elderly. It's right. The latter is not often reported. So in 1999, December of 1999, we launched Mekom Shalom. I had lost an aunt to suicide. And at age 74, and a woman came to see me and discussed her father's suicide, which she didn't know about her whole life. She knew he died when she was two, but she was told, of course, it was a heart attack. And then, as she put it to me, when she was finally told by her mother, like on her deathbed, that her father had taken his life, she said that her life both fell apart and came together in that one instant. And so we founded Mekom Shalom, and over the years, there have been all kinds of Jews taking part and non-Jews as well. And it doesn't matter that there's a Hasidic couple in the room and secular Jews and non-Jewish people. The commonality of this tragedy and this trauma of suicide is really a really important connection for all of them that they don't have outside. That it's still so stigmatized, as is mental illness, and so people are very alone with their burdens. And so Mekom Shalom has been really powerful for me and really meaningful. And incidentally, I co-lead it with Dr. Adina Greenberg, a wonderful psychologist and bereavement counselor, who is originally from Philadelphia. Mekom Shalom, if people are interested, they should certainly email me at syweintraub@gmail.com. My first initials, syweintraub@gmail.com. And the other group that I'm continuing with is bereaved parents who lost a young adult child. In that group, which is very strong, there are people who lost children between 16 and, say, 26, who died all unexpectedly of a mysterious virus years ago, or of a drowning, a seizure during the night. And a couple of overdoses, and unfortunately, we're getting a lot of calls about fentanyl overdoses. And again, they feel very alone and alienated in the community because people don't mention the name of their son or daughter. People don't know what to say. People, have talked about friends crossing the street and not calling. So these support groups are very important, and we do integrate into them as appropriate stories or holiday-related material as we approach Jewish holidays, or poetry, religious and secular, and it's really, you know, the groups really run themselves. I'm there as a resource person, the way we usually start is, if there's somebody new, we all introduce ourselves and say what brought us to the group, including myself and Dina. We then have a minute of not speaking, because the truth is that any one of the stories is far beyond words. And so we take a minute not to speak, and then usually somebody has something to put on the table right away, and they're off and running. And there's a lot of humor in the room, I wanted to say. It's interesting what an important spiritual resource that is. Sometimes it's dark humor, but sometimes it's just the need to laugh at absurdity. So I'm very, really honored to be continuing with both groups in my retirement.
Simcha, these meet on a weekly basis, a monthly basis?
Both groups are monthly. It's interesting because sometimes somebody will say, gee, can't we meet more often than once a month? And somebody else will say, do you really want to do this more than once a month? And I understand both comments are, you know, so we do encourage people, by the way, to follow up with each other, informally. If they both want to, that's great.
Now that
we're on Zoom, we can draw people from all over, and from different states, and also from Canada and Israel.
Right. That's why I wanted to make sure people understood this is still on Zoom. And again, if somebody wants to contact you, it's syweintraub@gmail.com. Is that correct?
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
And you alluded to this, I mean, with the suicide, the bereavement, the trauma of what we've gone through these last 2 years. We're also then, and also, and you just alluded to this, we're also experiencing this explosion of mental health concern. And how can Jewish texts and tradition support? I know we've published a Misha Berach for people dealing and families dealing with mental health issues. It's part of our workshop. But I think one of the things that again, you've helped pioneer is this wonderful reservoir of text stories, midrash, and tradition that speak to the general broad healing universe. Could you just talk a little bit about the power of text study in this movement?
Yeah, well, it took me time after rabbinical school to uncover what gems there were in both classical rabbinic sources and since and medieval texts and poetry that could be a source of guidance and understanding. I'll just give you one example. After Superstorm Sandy, when I was asked to a full year after, when I was asked to help a synagogue reopen, a synagogue that was basically still destroyed, but their entryway, the beautiful huge lobby was restored. So they were able to have services there and actually a barbecue. And, uh, and, So for the parents of the school, they asked me if I would lead a workshop after kind of plenary program. And the text I chose was a story of Rabbi Yoshua in the Talmud seeing survivors of the destruction of the temple becoming ascetics, really, denying themselves first meat. And he said, "Why do you deny yourselves meat?" And they said, "Well, how can we eat meat when we no longer have the altars to sacrifice in the temple?" So he said, "Well, then you shouldn't eat fruit either, because there's the celebration of the first fruits." So they said, "Okay, we'll do without fruit." And he said, "And what about water? You know, the festival of the drawing of the water and on the holiday of Sukkot, you know." So he then said to them, "You know, to ignore the loss is impossible, but to put on the community inordinate obligations of restraint and denying themselves is also impossible." So then the Talmud says, and this is why, when you are building a house, and stuccoing the outside, you leave an area near the door unstuccoed. And when somebody is serving a feast, they leave off one hors d'oeuvre, and they don't serve the one hors d'oeuvre. And when a woman puts on all her finery, she leaves off one jewel on her forehead. And finally it says, and when a groom is getting married, he puts ashes on his forehead. Very interesting. Thing, you know, obviously kind of devolved into the smashing of the glass, but these were all ways of incorporating the trauma into daily life and into ongoing life. So with these parents who were trying to figure out what to do with this and with their kids, they decided actually to have a mezuzah making workshop where and actually it was led by a survivor of the Holocaust, a man in his 80s who was an artist, and he led a workshop for making mezuzot, both for homes and for the shul. And so it just was a wonderful experience, and just an example of how to incorporate in the wisdom of our Jewish library into the work of this was actually a celebration, but we needed to figure out a way to integrate, a tradition that can seem very foreign and very unrelated. But all you have to do is build a bridge to it, you know, and it kind of responds and builds a bridge back to you.
Rabbi Simcha Weintraub, thank you for just your wisdom and your passion. And into helping to teach the American Jewish community about the richness of our tradition as it relates to healing and the human being and the presence of the sacred in those relationships. So thank you. And welcome to Philadelphia. Stay healthy, stay well, and hope to see you not on the expressway. Stay off the expressway. It's crazy, mm-hmm. But at least Midtown Avenue at some meeting when things open up a little bit. Simcha, thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you.
To all of you, again, thank you for watching today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the TV show and podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. Remember, the show is available also on the Roku streaming network. And if you have a question of what that is, ask a grandchild. They'll be happy to explain everything to you. If you'd like to make a tax-free donation, which is deductible, to further our work, go to the website homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, and scroll down to the donate button. Click it and just follow the directions. We really do appreciate your support. Seekers of Meaning is produced at the Broadcast Center of Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and a shout out to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next TV show and podcast, our Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy. Shalom.